This episode of the Nighttime Podcast is a direct continuation of my prior episode, the Sydney River McDonald's Murders Part 1. If you haven't already listened, I suggest you back up and start there first. My prior episodes are all available on iTunes or via my website, nighttimepodcast.com.
You are tuned to the Nighttime Podcast, focused on the fringe of Canada.
Welcome to part two of the Nighttime Podcast's coverage of the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. In the first episode of this series, our guest Fonz Jessam introduced us to 18-year-old McDonald's employee Derek Wood and his two co-conspirators in this crime, Darren Muse and Freeman McNeil. We also heard about the events and social dynamics that led to this trio forming and acting on a plan to rob the McDonald's restaurant where Derek had been working at, a scheme they expected to earn them upwards of $200,000. Fonz also guided us step by violent step through the robbery gone wrong that resulted in the permanent disability of 20-year-old Arlene McNeil and the brutal murders of 22-year-old Donna Warren, 29-year-old Neil Burrows, and 27-year-old Jimmy Fagan. In tonight's episode, we'll continue this story with the help of a favorite author of mine, Fonz Jessam. As part one concluded, the trio had just committed what is now known as Cape Breton's worst mass murder. As they started their getaway, they shot and killed Jimmy Fagan, who was entering the restaurant through the same door the three were exiting, this act having been witnessed by Fagan's cab driver. The local police, cab drivers, and our guest Fonz Jessam would all soon be making their way to the McDonald's restaurant. Fonz will now walk us through the trio's getaway, ultimately arriving at the first of several interviews Derek made with local police.
The getaway was probably the only part of this thing that was reasonably well planned. The car was parked across the street a distance away from the restaurant, so they ran across the highway, the 125, and got into the car. But before they get into the car, Freeman McNeil didn't want to have the shovel handle. He still had his shovel handle, because he was afraid it had blood on it and he would get blood in the car. So he threw it inside a culvert that ran under this dirt road. He just shoved it in there as far as he could get it to go. And then they jumped in the car and took off. And at this point, the realization settles over Derek that because he had to jam that back door open with his backpack to run and get his co-conspirators because they were running late, he never picked it up. It was still there. And it wasn't just any backpack. It had his McDonald's uniform and his McDonald's name tag. It was a neon sign pointing to Derek Wood. He had to explain that. He was afraid to go back and get it because they too had seen the cab driver, so they knew police would be on the way. He's realizing this in the back seat of the car as they're making their escape. So he informed Darren and Freeman that he forgot the knapsack. And they came up with this instant plan where he would say he was there smoking and that he heard shots and ran away. So they let him out of the car just before the Sydney River Bridge, before they crossed over to head up to Coxeth and up into the mountain road. And he ran the back road there, the name of which I've forgotten, and came across to King's Variety. The store is still there. I believe it's still a 24-hour store as well. And he ran in and said, "There's been a shooting. I heard shots. I work at McDonald's. I need a phone. I need a phone." The person behind the counter dialed. Derek reported it. He had started his cover story. He called and reported it. "I worked there. I heard it. I ran away." This explains the bag in his mind. This explains the bag. The Stan Jesty, who was the dispatcher for the RCMP, was in the process of juggling resources and dealing with getting the dog team there, getting everybody there and responding to this. When this kid called and said, "I worked at McDonald's, I heard something, I ran away." So he sounded like he was a witness, but not a witness. So Jesty said, "Just go home." He wrote down his name, "We'll get to you." So Derek tried to call his cousin to get picked up and taken home, but couldn't get through. His cousin was sleeping. So he decided to leave King's Variety and walk to Freeman McNeil's house to see if he could catch up to the other two. He got there, they weren't there, and he walked back to the store. And then he saw the roadblock. It was a Sydney police roadblock. So he headed there And he went up to talk to that police officer, and he was telling that police officer, I'm the worker. I called. I was there. And the roadblock police officer knew nothing other than something happened at McDonald's, and he was sent to set up a roadblock. Really, he had no information about the nature of the crime, but he knew if this was an employee, this was important. Coincidentally, an RCMP officer came along on an unrelated errand he was running, but he saw him, and the Sydney police officer said, talk to him, Brian Stoyer. So Derek went over and explained again, I'm Derek Wood, I was there, and Brian had heard his commanding officer explaining to other officers that they were trying to find this Derek Wood who had called Stan Jesty. So he realized, ah, okay, you're important. My other errand is no longer important. Get in the car. So Stoyak was told to take him back to the detachment and to wait, and they would question him later. So he was taken back and put in an interview room where he spent all of the rest of the next day.
Before we get to Derek's first interview with police, let's catch back up with Freeman and Darren and hear their actions after they let Derek out of the getaway car.
After the murders, when Derek Wood got out of the car to go create his alibi, they went to destroy evidence. They went to Freeman's house. They hid their clothing. They went and things that they felt were bloody and would lead police to them, they discarded, some in a brook not far from Freeman McNeil's house. Some they put into the Sydney Harbour near a bridge in North Sydney, and that evidence was never recovered. The tides took that away. And then, after getting rid of their evidence, making sure they were clean, they had clean clothes on, that's when the drive back to Sydney occurred, and all they got was 2,000 and change. Not 200,000, 2,000 and change. All of this over that. It's still frightening to think about. What did they do with the money? Darren Muse, in his statement to police, talked about the night of the murder when Freeman was driving him back to a convenience store he wanted to go to play poker machines. He drove past me on the highway and described seeing the ATV news van there. So this was within an hour of the killings. And he went to a convenience store and started to play video poker with money from those murders.
In the hours after the triple murder, Darren, now dressed in clean clothes, sat alone at a 24-hour convenience store playing video lottery, likely spending a good amount of the $2,000 they made off with. As Darren gambled, Derek Wood would also sit alone, just in his case it would be in a police interrogation room. Almost immediately, the police would be questioning his story and his explanation for the backpack being in the doorway.
His story was that he was smoking, and that he had heard the shooting and screams, and that he ran. They went back to check on the story. There were no cigarette butts anywhere near the rear door. They found out from other employees they had reached out to by then, whoever was working that shift, that he was smoking in the restaurant, that Don allowed him to sit at a table earlier in the evening. It didn't make sense to them. They suddenly became suspicious. His story wasn't working. If he could sit at the table and smoke and it was okay with Don an hour earlier, why did he have to hide out the back door and smoke now? Why was his bag there in the first place? If he's leaning there smoking, why did he leave his bag? Why wasn't it over his shoulder when he ran? Why wasn't it lying, you know, I mean, if you step outside to smoke, you're not going to necessarily leave your kit bag propping the door open. Maybe you are. But if he was still in the doorway close enough to hear the shots, they felt he was probably holding the door open and there were no cigarette butts. So they became suspicious of him right away. They felt he knew more. They did not think he was party to what was, at that point, the worst crime scene any of those officers had witnessed. They just couldn't put their head around this mop-headed little teenager doing that, but they thought perhaps he had somehow fallen in with a group of serious criminals and they had sucked him into holding the door open. And they were trying to get that out of him in the first day, but he wasn't going there. But what he did do was tell the truth about how he got to work. And that's where Freeman McNeil enters the picture. Freeman drove him to work that night. So police then had that name. So that was their first connection to Freeman. But he played hardball. He didn't talk. He was cocky in the interrogation. They didn't like the vibe, but they didn't believe he was capable of what they'd seen. They simply thought he was trying to protect someone he was either afraid of or in cahoots with, but they didn't believe him from the very beginning.
It's at this point that the news began to spread through Sydney, onto Nova Scotia, and ultimately around the world. Being the face and voice of this story, Fons Jessam has an interesting perspective on how the community and the world in general reacted to this story. I asked him about it, and he had a lot to say.
It was a story that took on a power of its own very quickly. On that first day, you know, if I walked into a Tim Hortons or anywhere else in Sydney, people would ask what was going on. There was a huge interest. We were getting that interest from the desk in Halifax. They were sending the satellite truck to Cape Breton for the very first time. As the story went on, I couldn't go anywhere without being asked about it. Everybody needed more information than they were getting. So it became the biggest story in Cape Breton, and it stayed that way for a very, very, very long time. Everybody wanted to know what happened, how it could happen. Everybody wanted to believe that the killers were from away. There had been a murder in Sydney I covered a couple of years earlier. Kenneth Dale Bright was an escaped American murderer, got across the border somehow, got into Sydney and murdered somebody. Got caught. Well, people wanted this to be another one like that, that nobody from Cape Breton could have done this. Nobody wanted to engage in the idea initially in Sydney that this could have been done there. But if you think about the scene of the crime, and I touched on that a moment earlier, it's a part of our childhood. We went to McDonald's as children for the Happy Meal. You went to McDonald's as teenagers, either to work or to pick up girls. It was a hangout. McDonald's was part of the North American culture. We all had a bit of McDonald's in us. We were all familiar with those golden arches. We were all familiar with those kids on the other side of the counter. And that's where the attack occurred. And I think that's what initially spurred that international interest. This was before the mass shootings became very regular events, and news became a 24-hour cycle, and people became numbed to this kind of violence. This was very unusual. The crime touched a piece of the North American fabric. McDonald's was part of that. You know, that's not a commercial for McDonald's, but that's a reality of growing up in the 70s, 80s. And then, you know, when this happened in the early 90s, the people who were the consumers of news were the people who grew up in the 70s and 80s, and this had happened in their restaurant.
Getting back to the ongoing investigation, as we heard prior, Derek's first interview left police with a lot to think about. They certainly had suspicions, but were far away from considering an arrest. As the investigation rolled on, the trio would have some time to reap the rewards of the triple murder. Let's hear how they spent the weeks after the crime and what they did with the $2,000 they killed for.
They didn't go anywhere. They stayed home. They didn't connect with each other. Darren went back about his life as though nothing had happened. He continued to gamble, hang out at the pool hall, and just be Darren. The only difference his friends noted was that he wasn't asking people for loans or looking for money because he never had money. Suddenly he had money. So he was spending. Freeman went to the music stores where he had laid away some components, some stereo components, and he purchased them with $5 bills. And he joked with one clerk who questioned, "What's with all the fives?" He said, "Well, you know, don't ever cash your pogie check at Wilco, free Walmart." And they just laughed it off. Yeah, they started spending right away. Derek never got a dime, didn't want a dime, didn't ask for a dime, never spent a dime. I think he was probably in shock, first of all, for having spent so many hours in police custody in the first few hours. Secondly, he knew these people, you know, and I think as the reality set in, he just didn't want the money. There was no meeting afterward or plan for what to do afterwards. So the other two just went about spending the money. And Derek went about being the shy guy that nobody really had much to do with. The only people interested in Derek were the RCMP.
At this point in our story, the police faced a tremendous amount of pressure to bring justice to those responsible. Yet aside from Derek's odd story and the torrent of rumors that were circulating the community, they didn't have a lot to go on. It was when a tip came in that seemed to have credibility that the investigation was turned on its head. The police were quick to act, and arrests were quickly made. Let's hear Fons talk us through this first set of arrests.
It walked in the door. In the form of a young woman who implicated her brother and a friend and said that she was with them in the car at the government wharf when they threw the gun in the harbor. Her evidence was sound, but our coverage was good. So she simply repeated what we'd reported. They brought in the emergency response team from Halifax to make the arrests because they realized they were arresting people who had used a gun and clearly were violent. I mean, they'd all seen that scene. Nobody wanted to knock on the door and ask a suspect to come in from questioning. They wanted to take these guys down hard. The busts were planned for early in the morning. They had the place, their homes staked out. One of them left home unexpectedly in his van. He was driving down the road and they rammed it with the ERT team and he didn't know what had happened. They were arrested in Hollywood fashion with machine guns pointed at them, balaclava wearing, Kevlar wearing police officers, scenes like Cape Breton had never seen. And word spread quickly that arrests had been made. The RCMP held a news conference at a hotel to celebrate the news. By then, it was starting to creep into their command structure that it might have been wrong. But the freight train was rolling. They had called this news conference at 3 p.m. We, for the very first time ever, decided at ATV to take this news conference live. I would host it from the scene, throw it back and forth, something I had never done and had no idea how to do. But that's an indication of how big this was, that we went live and interrupted the afternoon programming to bring the news that arrests had been made.
News of the arrests now announced and word spreading around the community that the accuseds would soon be making a court appearance, people gathered outside the courthouse hoping to get a look at the monsters responsible for this crime. Fonz was among the crowd outside the courthouse that day.
It didn't take long for a crowd to form at the Sydney courthouse. People lined up outside. They wanted a look at these guys. Well, they never made the court appearance in the afternoon, so we moved the satellite truck there and did the 6 o'clock news from there, waiting, still waiting. But I was beginning to get hints from some of my police sources that this may not be them. And that was not what I wanted to hear. That was not what anyone wanted to hear. You know, it was bad enough that they were local. People couldn't believe that, but we wanted arrests. Everybody wanted fast arrests, right? Let's make this thing go away. But by the 10 o'clock news that night, I was still live in the same parking lot reporting that they'd been released, that they were not involved, their alibis checked out, they were innocent. It's interesting, they had that feeling. I've interviewed people before who were innocent and arrested, and initially you feel this is stupid, this is, you know, a mistake. And you have that feeling of an innocent man, and they had that and never lost it. As serious as the police were and as angry as the police were, they believed, look, boys, check it out. We've got alibis, we're fine. And they never did get into that feeling that comes later when someone who was innocent and prosecuted realizes that this is going to stick to me somehow, this can't be happening, because they were very quickly vindicated by their friends and released. But that really, really hurt the RCMP officers involved in this case, because it was such a high, so fast, so Hollywood, got it, bang, nailed, you know, let's all go home. And then it was back to square one, boys. Let's take a look at this Wood character again. And you could see it in the body language. You could hear it in the officers I was talking to or share a cigarette with. They were crushed. The people of Sydney were as well. They wanted it to be true. And they would ask questions, you know, do you think that they did it and they got false out? And I constantly, you know, would say, no, it wasn't them. It was a mistake. It was a mistake. She was charged with mischief, which was the surest sign that it was a mistake. The police charged the person who came in. At that time, it was sort of the death knell. You know, it told you, yeah, this was wrong. They charged the person who reported them.
With the first set of arrests amounting to not much more than an embarrassment, the police were now back to square one. It's at this point they would need to refocus their investigation on the only real lead they had, Derek Wood.
Well, they went back to Wood after realizing that the first arrests were false arrests. He was all they had. They knew he hadn't told them the truth, certainly not all of the truth, and they needed to find out more, but they weren't ready at this point to bring him back in for another round of questioning because they simply didn't have the evidence. So what they did was they went about preparing the tedious amount of paperwork required at the time, and I suspect still today, to get a wiretap, so that they could tape conversations in the home where he was staying and in a payphone that this special observation team had seen him using. Very difficult to get wiretap on a payphone. The agreement then was when the officers saw him on the phone, they could record. And if anyone else in the house that he was staying in were using the phone, they couldn't record. It was simply the wiretap, while it was for two phone lines, was actually for Derek Wood. And this wasn't his home, which made it more complicated. But again, he was all they had, but they had nothing. They had suspicions. So they needed to build a case. They were still pulling together the pieces of the forensic evidence gathered inside the restaurant. You know, and this was before people even knew what forensic evidence was, and certainly before television convinced people that you could get DNA out of a cloud in the sky and turn it in 24 hours. I mean, forensic science is a slow, methodical process. So, you know, they had footprints. They had taken his shoes on the first time they had it, first because they knew there were footprints downstairs. But there hadn't been a match made yet. So they had their suspicions. They focused on him and then went to see Freeman McNeil because, of course, he gave them Freeman. There was no need for him on that first day of questioning to say, Freeman drove me to work. That was the dumbest thing he could possibly have done because he sent the police to go talk to Freeman McNeil. He could have said, I took a bus to work. He could have said, I walked to work. But he told them Freeman McNeil drove him to work. So, of course, they had to go interview Freeman McNeil. Wasn't what Freeman expected.
In an attempt to verify the details of Derek's story, the investigators' next step would be to speak with Freeman McNeil. As it would turn out, Freeman was no better than Derek at concealing the important details. Fonz will talk us through Freeman's first interview now.
He had the look and bearing of a police officer. He had worked as a private security guard, was looking to get into that, and the police wanted to like him, and they did. They had no qualms about the story he gave that, yeah, he drove him to work, dropped him off, and he, at the time that he fled the restaurant with Darren Muse after dropping Wood off, he did go to his home to hide the money, and his mother woke. So he told her at that time he had to get a puffer for his girlfriend who had asthma that she had left it at the house. So he needed to explain that. And Darren was with him. So he gave the police Darren. In his statement, he said he was driving through Sydney, saw a buddy of his over by Pocket's Pool Hall, which was where Darren Muse would hang out, picked him up, said, do you want to go for a drive? I got to go get my girlfriend's puffer. They went up, got the puffer, came back, all easily checked, but now he gave them Darren Muse. So they now had to go talk to Darren Muse as well about, you know, to confirm Freeman's story. But they had no doubts about Freeman. They really did believe him. The first four police officers who encountered him and questioned him believed him. He was a good sell. He convinced them of everything he said, and they were willing to accept it as gospel. They just thought he was just some guy they'd be calling to the witness stand to say, yes, I dropped Derek Wood at the restaurant at the beginning of a shift that night, end all. No further involvement in this event. They had no sense whatsoever that he was involved.
We just heard how Freeman's mother had seen her son and Darren Muse together in the hours after the McDonald's murders. This left Freeman with little choice but to share with police that he and Darren were together that night. Now having interviewed Derek and Freeman, the investigation's next stop would be with Darren Muse. It's also at this point the interviewers would start requesting polygraphs.
Muse, he raised the suspicion of Sergeant Phil Scarf, who didn't like reporters then. But he was a very, very, very serious police officer and polygraph officer. And he had set up in North Sydney to give polygraphs to all the witnesses so they would make sure this thing was done by the book. So the first day Darren Muse was picked up, he was asked if he could just give a polygraph as well to support his statement that, yes, Freeman McNeil picked me up, we went to his house, then he dropped me off at a sanitary dairy where people had seen him gambling that night. That was his story. He didn't want any part of Phil Scarf or the polygraph. And Scarf's antenna went off right away. He felt, there's something with this guy. This guy's not right. There's something wrong here. They didn't have any reason to believe he was involved in the crime, but Scarf didn't understand why a kid who got in a car, drove to a guy's house, and then drove to a store wouldn't take a polygraph. He claimed he was too tired. He didn't know he needed this. Anyway, he talked them out of the polygraph on the first go round. And he was taken back to his home. But now he went from being a simple witness to a person of interest. And the police officer convinced him as he dropped him off and told his parents, "We need your help in this, Darren. We want to take you over tomorrow. You're tired now. We'll do a polygraph tomorrow." So he had managed in his first meeting with Phil Scarf to go from incidental, meaningless witness to somebody we need to have a closer look at. Derek led them to Freeman. Freeman led them to Darren. So now they had the trio. They just didn't know it.
With Darren avoiding the polygraph on the first meeting with police, the very next morning he wouldn't be so lucky. This second interview would be much more intense, and the results would change everything.
On that second day, when Darren went over again, he had convinced the officer who was with him that he was just afraid of Phil Scarf. That's believable. Phil Scarf was a very intense guy. But they said, "That's okay. We have another polygrapher, nicer guy. He'll do it with you." So the ultra-confident Darren Muse convinced himself that through his martial arts training, he could calm his body and beat the machine. So he went and they did a test first. And the test they did involved a deck of cards. You pick a card. You look at that card, put it back in the deck. Don't tell me what it is. I'm shuffling the cards. So now we're going to ask you to say no. I'm going to show you back all the cards. This is what the polygraph officer was explaining to Darren Muse. I will show you all the cards and you have to say no. So they went through the deck. Is this your card? No. Is this your card? No. Is this your card? No. So I went through the full deck. Then the polygrapher went through, pulled out the card, said, "That's your card." It was his card. And then he showed him how his body had betrayed him when the lie came up. Muse wanted practice. He said, "Let's do it again." And the polygrapher said, no, that's a waste of time. You understand now that it works." So he still kind of thought he could beat them. He didn't. He failed. And where he failed was, "Do you know anything about the robbery? Were you involved in the robbery? Do you know who was involved in the robbery?" The questions. They didn't ask him if he shot anybody, but he failed. So now he's a man of serious interest to the investigators, but they have nothing. They kept him there for quite a while, but he whined and cried and managed to finally convince them, "You said I could go home. You said I could go home. You said I could go home." Well, legally, he could go home. He wasn't asking for a lawyer. He just wanted to go home. So they let him, and the police officer drove him home, went in and spoke to his parents and said, "There's something wrong. He knows something, and he's not telling, and we need him to be honest." And his parents lit into him and said, "You've got to tell them everything you know." And he said, "Well, I'll think about it. I don't know what I..." And he went to his room, and they left him there and left for the night. And he faked his own suicide attempt that night and wrote a very self-serving letter about he knew who did it. It was guys from Halifax, but they'd kill him if he talked, and said they'd kill his family. And "I can't, you know, subject you to this danger, so I'm going to end my own life." And allegedly took some pills and alcohol, and but more or less wrote a suicide note that was to cover the failed polygraph test.
With investigators now confident they were on the right track, they would next look deeper into Darren Muse's activities the night of the McDonald's murder. To better understand the events of that night, investigators would request a second interview with Freeman McNeil. It's with this interview that things would really begin to go downhill for this trio.
Then they went to Freeman McNeil and wanted his polygraph again. The officers believed Freeman that he had no involvement other than driving his friend to work. And they expected his polygraph to be one of the very quick routine ones, like some of the McDonald's workers they had done, you know, who had seen what happened earlier in the day, the taxi drivers, other people they were doing were all passing. These were all witnesses. And that's all he was to them, was a witness. Well, he failed. And that was the beginning of the end for the three of them. Because his answer to having failed was to slowly give statements that he knew some, that he knew it was Derek and Darren, that they did it, that he wasn't involved, then he was involved a little bit. He complained that they kept him there so long, but they had no choice because he kept changing his statement. They had to keep trying to verify what he was saying. But by this point, he was in North Sydney handing them everything, accept anything to incriminate him. Even in his most incriminating statement, he claimed he blacked out. He didn't know what his involvement was. He remembered hitting the guy with the stick. He remembered Derek going crazy, shooting everybody. He denied ever having the gun. He said, "I think I remember seeing Darren Muse put the gun in my hand and the gun went off when there was a guy in the doorway." That's as close as he came to admitting, you know, that he was the one who shot Jimmy Fagan. But it blew away the investigators. They suddenly had everything, even though they recognized that this guy was trying to reduce his own involvement. And for whatever reason, McNeil believed he was still going to get out of jail that night, despite giving them all this. He learned differently. And when he finally did give, we're talking like a very long overnight into the next day kind of period of time. He did get to talk to a lawyer. In the point where he finally gave it all up, one of the guys taking the statement needed a break and stepped out, and his lawyer was there. And the officer's heart just sank, because they were at the point where he was finally, really, this statement admitting that he was involved and who did what to whom, when, and where. And it fit the evidence they all knew from the scene, so they knew they weren't being lied to this time. And they had to let the lawyer go in. The lawyer requested, and they thought it was over. We're not getting anything. And then went back in, and McNeil said, "No, I still want to. I want to get it. I want to get it all out. I want to help you guys." And this is a testament to how they had worked and worked and worked and worked on his humanity, on everything they could to try and befriend him. I mean, it's an art, right? The art of interrogation. And they were good at it. And they had won him over to the point where, even though a lawyer went in and said, "Shut up," he said to the lawyer, "Okay." And then he said to the police, "I'll continue." And he did. And that was the most damning statement, the one where he admitted pretty much everything except his own involvement. He blacked out.
As police hear the various versions of Freeman McNeil's confessions, they are now certain they have found those responsible for this mass murder. With Freeman already in police custody, a highly trained emergency response team would be dispatched to arrest Derek Wood and Darren Muse. Fonz was there when Derek was arrested outside a busy downtown bar.
I was there when Derek Wood was arrested. I was there and I wasn't there. We had gear problems. I was talking to that Special O interrogator I mentioned to you, the observation guy, and I was just chatting him up outside his car. It was on a Friday night, and I had been in the habit of listening to his radio very carefully during our conversations. I'd split my mind and listen to him and be able to engage in the conversation, but I was really more interested in hearing what his radio was saying, because we didn't have that channel on our scanner. And I heard the Irish Club and Daniels, and then he said, "I gotta go." So I ran in and grabbed the cameraman and said, we're going to one of these two places. I don't know which. I had a close source, not directly connected to the investigation, but a longtime member of the emergency response team. And he told me to go look for a group of guys who look at a place outside a bar. You know what a police officer looks like. You know these guys, the ERT guys, are much more fit. They're going to be trying to fit in. They're a little older. They're all going to be built like they push weights all the time. So I went looking for that and found it very quickly outside the Irish Club, four of them, trying to talk to people in the line and just trying to plan if they were going to go in for the evening or not and just blend in, waiting for Derek to come out. They didn't want to go in to the club and create a scene, but Derek and his cousin, who was arrested initially because they thought he was involved, were both in there. So when they come out, which is when we came back around the corner, they slammed them up against the wall. "You're under arrest. You're charged in the murder of," bang, bang, in the car. Poof, they were both gone. Darren Muse was another story. He was home in bed, and they kept him there. He had gone home, and they knew that's where he was, so they knew they were in no hurry. He wasn't going anywhere. So they got Muse and took him to a different detachment, but he played pretty hardcore. He had learned the first time that just because these guys have you doesn't mean they have you. And he knew that he could just wait them out because he had done it a week earlier. So he was the experienced criminal now, so he was not going to give up anything.
At this point in our story, all three are in police custody. Freeman has already confessed, ultimately pointing the finger at his two co-conspirators. The ever-confident Darren Muse had very little to say to the investigators. However, Derek Wood was more willing to talk. We'll pick up the story with Fonz Jessam describing the police interrogation of Derek Wood.
He wasn't so hard to break once they showed him what Freeman had said. because Freeman took them on a drive-through after his statement and showed them where everything was. But Derek, to his credit, when he finally broke, they had the indictment in front of him with all the charges. He went, guilty, guilty, not guilty, guilty, not sure. He admitted what he did. He told them what he did. He told them he didn't know what was going on with Neil Burrows, but that he admitted he shot him at least once and maybe twice. When they said Burrows had been shot twice, he said, well, I know I shot him once. But he wasn't saying he didn't fire that second shot, but he admitted he shot him. He admitted everything he did, and he put nothing on the other two, other than to say that Freeman McNeil came, he thinks it was Freeman, who took the gun from him in the office, and that's how the gun ended up back in play with others when they left and Jimmy Fagan got shot. But he took them to a place where he helped Darren Muse hide his money. It was a pond where they were smoking drugs after the crime, and Darren wanted to hide his plastic bag full of twos. They robbed McDonald's, yeah. In 1992, where you, I'm sure, could get a Big Mac for $1. So he put it underneath a log in a pond underwater. Really hard to get at. In fact, the police couldn't find it when he took them there. And finally, Wood himself said, let me get it. So they took the cuffs off him and he went out and he got it. So when they showed that to Darren Muse and he realized, my buddies have turned me in. There's no way they could have that money unless Derek took them, because only two people in the world knew where that money was, him and Derek. And he sure as hell didn't tell them. So then he was the last to break. He too gave a self-serving statement in which he implicated the others that their role was much more significant than his. The only thing he admitted to doing was slicing the throat of Neil Burrows, which he said he did to try and put him out of his misery because he was suffering. He even tried to make that appear to be an act of mercy. So he gave a statement that implicated Freeman in the shooting of Jimmy Fagan, and he said he shot Burrows and clubbed Burrows and was the main participant in the torture of Neil Burrows. Both Freeman McNeil and Darren Muse described Derek Wood as going crazy with the gun, and none of them expected that. But by 16, 18 hours, the police had all three confessing. All three gave it up. The only one who really did what inmates in prison would consider a solid confession was Derek Wood. This is what I did, is what he said.
With all three men admitting to playing a role in this mass murder, it would seem that the story's on its way to a quick resolution. As you'll hear in part three of this series, the three trials that follow these confessions are a story all in their own. To prepare you for what will come in the next episode, Fonz will set up the first hurdle.
Two top lawyers from the legal aid office in Sydney were representing Derek. Each lawyer was going to try and get, for whatever reason he could, the confessions thrown out, because if they can get the confession thrown out, any evidence gathered after that confession as a result of that confession is fruit of the poison tree. It can't be introduced. So the prosecutors knew that was going to be the big fight. Getting back to the confession he finally did make, that moment when he picked up the paper and went guilty, guilty, not guilty, guilty, not sure. He had asked to see, he said, I think I want to talk to my lawyer. And this was after he'd been in custody for a very long time and they were getting close. And the officer said, are you sure you're going to be able to get him? And he said, what time is it? And he said, 5 o'clock in the morning. Well, and then he continued the conversation. So the question was going to be, was he denied counsel? That was sort of the tilting point in his trial. That was what had the family sick, that enraged Neil Burrows' brothers.
With that, we will end part two of this series covering the 1992 Sydney River McDonald's murders. In part three, which will be released in the coming weeks, the story will pick up just where we left off with the first of the three trials. I would again like to thank Fonz Jessam for appearing in this episode. For anyone who is as taken by his storytelling as I am, I can't recommend his new book, Disposable Souls, enough. If you're interested in hearing more content from the Nighttime Podcast, you may be interested in joining the Nighttime Patron Group, where for $1 per month, you'll have access to a monthly bonus episode. You can join by visiting patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. That's patreon.com/nighttimepodcast. And with that said, on behalf of myself and the show's listeners, I'd like to thank the continued support of the show's current patron supporters and welcome the newest members to the group, Kira and Ingrid. In addition to providing me pride and motivation, without you, the production of the show is impossible. I'd like to thank you for listening to the Nighttime Podcast. If you enjoy your time here, please take a moment and rate, review, and subscribe to the show on iTunes. To stay up to date with the show, follow me on Facebook at facebook.com/nighttimepodcast and on Twitter, where my handle is @nighttimepod. If you have any story ideas or feedback on the show, I always enjoy hearing from you at nighttimepodcast@gmail.com. I look forward to talking to you again soon.
The Nighttime Podcast is written, hosted, and produced by Jordan Bonaparte. Copyright Jordan Bonaparte.